Good morning. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Joy Cardine. It's 10 minutes past 8 o'clock on this Wednesday, September the 19th. Well, the Federal Reserve's decision yesterday to cut a key interest rate by a half point has buoyed investors on Wall Street. The Dow surged nearly 336 points on the news yesterday, recording its largest one-day gain in about 5 years. So why did that move by the Fed give investors a big boost of confidence? And what has all the bad news of late about the economy, the fears of a recession, the mortgage meltdown, the foreclosures, the poor home sale, the credit crunch, how has this affected our own investing habits? Well, some of the answers lie in the new study, the new field of neuroeconomics. We'll find out what that is this hour, and we will find out from our guest why it's important to understand this. It might help us make better financial decisions. 1-800-642-1234, 1-800-642-1234, our toll-free number if you'd like to join in with a thought or a question about your own relationship with money and with money-making or maybe money-losing decisions. In Madison, 263-1890. Our guest is Jason Zweig, a senior writer for Money Magazine. He has been a guest columnist for Time Magazine and CNN.com. He is the author of Your Money and Your Brain, a new book out published by Simon & Schuster, How the New Science of Neuroeconomics Can Help Make You Rich. Good morning.
Good morning, Joy. It's great to be with you.
Well, thanks a lot for being with me. So this can really help make us rich.
Well, I think it can certainly help prevent you from getting poor. And, you know, the wonderful thing that many people don't realize about financial decisions and investing in general is it's simple, but it's not easy. And many people think it's complicated, and that stops them from getting started. It's very simple to invest successfully, but it's not easy. And I tend to liken it to losing weight. Losing weight is simple. Everybody knows what the two things are you need to do, right? And what are they, Joy?
Oh, you eat less and exercise more.
That's it. But those things aren't easy. Mm-hmm. Nothing could be simpler. But that doesn't mean that they're easy.
Yeah. Well, if it's, you know, simple to invest, why do so many of us find it so hard?
Well, because it's not easy. And the reason it's not easy is because the thinking part of your brain pretty much knows what to do. But the emotional part of your brain gets in the way. And very much like someone who, in a cool, collected moment, says, you know, the next time I see that piece of chocolate cake, I'm going to say no. But then once the chocolate cake slides across the table, dives into it face first and stuffs the whole thing right down, investing works that way too. We can plan ahead. The problem is we don't live up to our plans in the heat of the moment. And at market extremes, like the bull market we had in July when the Dow was at 14,000, and then the bear market extremes of August when the market had come down 10% in a matter of days, at moments like that, your resolve just melts away. And that's why it's so important not just to put your plans in place in advance, but to make sure you follow them.
Yeah. Well, I'm putting this in concrete terms for me. I have my husband and I were both ready to make an annual investment in a Roth IRA, and it was a matter of when to do that. And when the market was up down up down up down, I just froze and I didn't do anything.
Mm-hmm.
And is that typical, or is that what you're talking about here?
It's very typical. Mm-hmm. And you know, there are a few, in the book I give a variety of tips on how you can use neuroeconomics to give you ideas on implementing successful plans. But one thing you certainly want to do is you want to stop paying attention to what the market is doing. It's very difficult to get that entry point perfectly right. What matters a lot more is getting in the first place. And, you know, if you want to make a contribution to your Roth, the best thing to do is to pick a date a few months in advance when you'll write the check. And then when that date comes, you just write the check and you send it in, and you don't worry about what level the market is at that moment.
Yeah. And so why not worry? Shouldn't I be paying attention to these things so I make the best move? I invest in the best mutual fund. Shouldn't I be really, you know, studying all this rather than just ignoring what's happening?
It's very important, Joy, to distinguish between the things you feel you should be able to control and the things you actually can control. Investors have a very bad habit when the stock market goes down of sort of jumping in front of it the way you might jump in front of a runaway train. And they jump up and down and they wave their arms around and they say, stop, stop, stop going down. But, you know,
that
stock
doesn't
market,
work.
It doesn't work. The stock market will just run you over. If it's going to go down, it's going to go down and it's going to take you down with it. What you can control is your own attitude and your own behavior. And you need to recognize that you're not investing in your Roth IRA for this year. You're investing for way down the road. And because of that, what the market does this year, especially what it does this week or this day, is not all that relevant to the result you'll get in the long run. And if you wait, you may wait and wait and wait and just keep procrastinating and never write that check. So it's important to write the check on the date you commit to.
Yeah. So tell us how this neuroeconomics can explain, if it can explain, the big boost to Wall Street yesterday because of the cut in interest rates.
I think it's pretty easy to explain, Joy. What neuroeconomics has shown is that there are two systems in the human brain. One is what we like to think about when we think we're thinking, which is our logical, rational, long-term planning brain, where we deliberate and weigh the evidence and put things in perspective. And it's good we have that. The other is a much more primitive emotional system that specializes in what you might call hot thinking. And these two systems generate different sorts of perspectives. The hot emotional brain is very keen on expectation. It really reacts to what it believes will happen down the road. And the hope of gain and the fear of loss usually turn out to be more intense than the actual experience. Imagining that you'll make money gives you, in many ways, more pleasure than actually getting it. And so I think what happened yesterday is when the Fed cut interest rates, investors said, wow, it's going to be great a few months from now when, you know, this has its ripple effect throughout the economy. Housing will recover. People will have more money to spend. Stock price will go up. So let's buy stocks now before it's too late. And what we're likely to find a few months down the road is that the economy is influenced by a lot of factors other than what the Federal Reserve does to interest rates. And the big pop that people expected down the road may never materialize. So the market has priced in the future gains and maybe more than the future gains all in one day, and we're likely to get at least a mild disappointment.
Yeah. And talk a little bit about how there's actually science behind this, that you can take an MRI of the brain when mm-hmm. you're making these various financial decisions, or, you know, doing experiments that mimic that. And you can, how does your brain react to, for instance, the making money?
Well, yeah, this to me was the most fascinating mm-hmm. part of putting the book together in the course of researching it over the past couple of years. I participated in roughly a dozen studies in neuroeconomics labs around the country, and one of the things that typically researchers do in these labs is they give you an MRI brain scan while you're participating in a simple investing experiment inside the MRI tube. It's not for claustrophobics.
Mm-hmm.
What typically happens is this enables the neuroeconomists to tease out the different regions of the brain that are involved in making financial decisions. And one of the key discoveries is that long-term planning, like your commitment to put money into your Roth IRA with your husband, takes place in the rational or logical part of the brain, but has very little emotion attached to it. It's a very sort of neutral, mm-hmm. abstract motivation, and it can very easily be derailed by the emotions of the moment. It's a very committing to save is neurologically a very fragile thing. You can get knocked off track so easily, and that's a very important thing to realize. You have to protect your best instincts from your worst instincts of the moment.
Yeah, and but the thought of making all that money on that investment or getting that big return when we retire with that money, shouldn't that be motivating me to do that?
Yes, it should. In order for it to do that, though, you have to play some tricks on yourself.
Mm-hmm.
And there's a simple reason for it. What's even more rewarding is taking a piece of that money and going out and buying yourself some new shoes or
yeah.
some CDs. Or
how about a lottery ticket?
Or a lottery ticket. And that instant, the instant gratification that you get when you spend money on yourself will overpower the deferred gratification you anticipate from a good decision down the road. That's why you need to invest following policies and procedures rather than going on impulse. And the way I like to put it is the fewer decisions you make, the better off you'll be. You shouldn't actually be deciding anything. You should simply be following a roadmap, and you should commit to everything in advance, and when the date comes, you do it automatically, and otherwise you don't do anything.
Yeah. We are talking with Jason Zweig. He is the author of the new book, Your Money and Your Brain, How the New Science of Neuroeconomics Can Help Make You Rich. He is also the editor of The Intelligent Investor and is a columnist for Time Magazine and CNN.com. We welcome your questions about neuroeconomics and your money and your brain. 1-800-642-1234. 1-800-642-1234. In Madison, 263-1890. Do you ever wonder why you make the wrong financial decisions? Are you really confident when it comes to making the right investment choice? We welcome your questions for our guest. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network. You're listening to the Ideas Network. I'm Joy Cardine. Good to have you with us. Hope you stay tuned. Coming up, Ben Marins is with you this afternoon between 4 and 6 for At Issue. And coming up after 5, relationships with some people can be a constant drain on your energy. According to Ben's guest after 5, a look at how these toxic people can make you feel confused, manipulated, and miserable, and how you can empower yourself to put a stop to it. That's after 5, At Issue with Ben Marins. We're talking about empowering ourselves with the knowledge to make the right financial decisions and talking about our relationship with money. Talking with the author of the book, Your Money and Your Brain, Jason Zweig. How the New Science of Neuroeconomics Can Help Make You Rich. 1-800-642-1234 in Madison, 263-1890. Or send an email to talk@wpr.org. So what is your relationship with money? Are you a confident investor? Are you a fearful investor? Are you someone who, do you like to buy lottery tickets? Why do you do that? Anything that has to do with money and decisions, financial decisions, our guests can help us understand why we make the decisions we do and why so many people, smart people, make the wrong financial decisions. 1-800-642-1234 in Madison, 263-1890. Because a lot happens inside our brains when we even think about money. Talk more about exactly what the science of neuroeconomics is, Jason Zweig.
Well, Joy, it's a combination, as you might guess from the name, of neuroscience and economics with a great deal of psychology thrown in, too. And it uses the modern technology of imaging to essentially take video of the human brain in the process of making financial decisions. And we can see, for example, how people react to losing money, how they anticipate making money, how they form long-term plans for the financial future, how they think about investing outside their home country relative to keeping all their money here at home. Lots of these issues have been looked at, and we are learning a great deal about what the human brain is good at and not so good at when it comes to money.
Yeah. So all of us can't go through these MRIs to really understand our brain and our relationship with money. So how is understanding this new field, how can this help us in our day-to-day financial decisions?
I think there are two central lessons that come out of this research. The first is that we all think we have more willpower and self-control than we actually do. You know, it's easy in a calm moment to think that when push comes to shove, you'll be able to do the right thing. But then, you know, when the stock market crashes 500 points in 35 seconds, that resolve just goes flying out the window. So the first thing you need to realize is not to trust yourself and to design a financial plan of action that will enable you to have good systems in place that don't rely on willpower. That's the first lesson. The second is that we make a great many of our financial decisions under the influence of unconscious factors. I think it was J.P. Morgan who said every person has two reasons for everything he does: the reason he thinks and the real reason. And in all too many cases, the real reason is something we're entirely unaware of. You know, you may think you decided to sell that stock or mutual fund because you determined that it wasn't a good investment anymore. But in fact, it might be because you saw the color red flashing on a computer screen and that raised your panic level, and you had no conscious awareness that that had happened to you.
Yeah. This book came out of an article that you wrote some years ago. What was it called? The Murphy's Law of Investing?
Yes, parts of the book did grow out of that, and there certainly is a Murphy's Law of Investing. I think virtually everyone who's ever invested a dime has experienced it. You know, I think most people know Murphy's Law says whatever can go wrong will go wrong. I think Murphy's Law of Investing is whatever can go wrong will go wrong in the worst possible way at the worst possible time when you least expect it.
Yeah, like I'm one of those people that I know that I will pick the the line at the grocery store checkout that's going to move the slowest. So does that mean I've got a flawed relationship with money?
Well, it may mean you could improve your shopping habits a little, Joy. What it really means is that our perception plays tricks on us. You know, it's possible to demonstrate mathematically, although probably not on the radio, that whichever line you pick in the grocery store will be the worst line. And what happens is people ignore a basic fact about financial physics, which is the sort of the law of financial gravity. Whatever goes up must come down, and whatever has gone up the most is likely to come down the most. And what trips people up with Murphy's Law is we tend to get most excited about investing whatever has gone up the most. You know, if you were buying socks, you wouldn't become more eager to buy them when Kmart or Target raised the price. You'd become more eager to buy them when they put them on sale. But when you're buying stocks instead of socks, you become much more eager to buy them when the price goes up. And therefore, you set yourself up for Murphy's Law of the financial markets, which is if you buy something that's just been going up and up and up and up in price, it's highly likely that it's going to stop going up right after you buy it.
Yeah, and it's attractive to us because we think everybody wants this. I should have this too. And then that's when it's at its high.
Correct. And also, the brain is very attuned to motion. And when you see, particularly on a market website, when you see a stock or on CNBC or any other place that shows stock prices in real time, when you see the price of a stock going up and then going up again, your brain literally determines automatically that it's going to continue going up. It's almost impossible to resist that impulse. So one of the best things you can do is actually not watch CNBC all day long and not click on that market website over and over again. The fewer times you look, the fewer times you're likely to see a pattern that isn't really there.
Yeah. So that's why too many of us will buy high and sell low when we should be doing the opposite.
Correct.
Yeah. And what about we buy high and it's going down, 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 but we know that it's going to go back up. And
Well, this is all part of what in the book I call the prediction addiction. The brain is designed to make us believe that the financial markets are more predictable than they really are. Whatever's happening, we think we know what is about to happen. And the best way you can combat this tendency in your own mind is to get out of the business of trying to predict what's going to happen. You know, the professionals on Wall Street earn their money with the attempt to make those predictions, and they're not very good at it. In fact, they're terrible at it. But they get paid a lot of money to be wrong. Individuals can choose not to play the prediction game at all. You can simply own a diversified portfolio that makes lots of small bets on all the companies in the United States and, for that matter, in the world. Just buy it and hold it indefinitely, and your costs will be very low, and you won't be constantly making decisions, and you won't constantly be second-guessing yourself and thinking you know what's coming next. You can just say, well, I don't care. In the long run, it'll probably be fine. And guess what? It will.
We're talking with Jason Zweig. He's the author of the book, Your Money and Your Brain, How the New Science of Neuroeconomics Can Help Make You Rich. Talking about what happens inside our brains when we think about money or when we make financial decisions and how understanding how our brain reacts is important to know in making the right financial decisions. 1-800-642-1234 in Madison, 263-1890. David and Marion is with us. Hi, David. You're on the air.
Good morning. My question is, if the emphasis for the common person is just to invest and not pay attention to what's happening to your money, why isn't the average person given the advice to just put it in a savings account safely in a bank so they don't have to worry about that?
Well, David, that's a good question. You could do that. It depends on your investment horizon and what your goals are. If you have a major savings objective within the next, say, 3 to 5 years, a down payment on a house, a college tuition payment to make, maybe an expensive marriage for one of your kids that you need to pay for, that could be a very sensible approach. If, however, you're investing for the longer-term future, say 10 years or 20 years out, either for yourself or maybe for your heirs, which is how I would regard my money, then I think that's probably a little too conservative. You know, if you're putting all your money in a savings account, your risk of losing money is essentially zero. But your risk of not keeping up with inflation and also of earning lower returns than you could get in other assets like the stock or even the bond market is quite high. And one of the mistakes investors tend to make is they avoid certain kinds of risk without realizing that that incurs other kinds. And there's really no risk-free investment. Everything has a risk, either in itself or the opportunity risk that you incur by not investing in something that might have been better. So those are the real issues, I think, for someone who's looking to minimize risk. Namely, you have to remember that even things that sound risk-free do carry some kinds of risk.
Yeah, thanks, David. What about, I know I've talked with my financial advisor, and I'm in some, I don't know if you call them risky investments, but the faster growth investments, and we talked about what kind of risk tolerance I have. I think that's the term that was used. But, you know, so I'm in these riskier investments, but I'm terrified of losing money. I don't want to lose this money. So what explains that?
Well, Joy, this is you've hit sort of a sore spot for me, which is that financial advisors are required, actually, by regulation in this country to spend a lot of time talking to their clients about this question of risk tolerance.
Mm-hmm.
It's kind of a phony issue. And it's phony because what we've learned about the brain in the past 5 to 10 years, especially through neuroeconomics, is people are very poor at predicting how they'll respond to risk before it hits them.
Yeah, so, case point number one.
Right. Mm-hmm. Well, here you are saying you're terrified of...
I'm not really terrified, but I don't like the thought of it, and I'm nervous, and I don't even look at my statements because I don't want to see.
Right. Mm-hmm. And, you know, taking that position, you may well be right, mm-hmm. but when the moment actually comes and you actually lose money, you may find either that it hurts even worse than you thought, or more likely, in my opinion, it actually doesn't bother you as much as you expected it did. So when your financial advisor sits there and says, so, Joy, you know, how much risk can you tolerate? Mm-hmm. You give some kind of answer, but you don't really know. It's mm-hmm. a lot like many of the other things we go through in life where, you know, we ride on a roller coaster, and while we're on the roller coaster, we're screaming in terror and gripping the rails like we couldn't believe, and then we jump off at the end, and somebody says, how was it? And what do we say?
Oh, it was great.
It was great. And, you know, that sort of thing happens all the time. The brain is designed to expect things differently from how we actually experience them. And risk is very hard to measure emotionally in advance. And because of that, I think most people are best off with a mix of very safe assets, moderately risky assets, and then maybe a tiny, tiny portion of things that are, you know, fairly risky, and really segregate those so that if you do find the pain of owning them is too intense, you can just kind of jettison them overboard.
Yeah, that's probably what I have anyway.
But you'll find out.
Yeah. Michael and Madison, hi, you're on the air.
Hi, how are you?
Hi, Michael.
I tend to be a little bit on the opposite, and with the recent market downturn, I did some investing. I started buying shares on the way down because I figured that in the long term that things were going to turn around, and I figured that things were on sale. And I also did some investing in some interest-sensitive instruments that I knew they were probably going to pressure the Fed to drop rates, and so I went in there, and I did invest in some interest-bearing accounts. And I guess since I've been an investor, since I've been a teenager, that I've kind of attuned my brain to kind of just go forward with this, or how do you explain some of that mentality?
Well, Michael, it sounds as if you're what professional investors call a contrarian, somebody who's a little ornery and sees what the crowd is doing and goes the other way. And in the long run, people like that tend to do very well. You know, Warren Buffett likes to say that his goal is to be fearful when other people are greedy and to be greedy when other people are fearful. And it sounds to me very much as if when you sensed the panic in the markets in around August of this summer, you said, well, maybe that's not a bad thing for me, and you stepped up to the plate and did some buying while so many other people were selling out of fear. And yes, you absolutely can train your brain to do that. One of the ways I usually advocate that people do it is just keep a little emotional journal. You know, just write down one or two sentences a day about how the market and your portfolio are making you feel. And chances are, in July, when the Dow was at 14,000 and, according to all the experts, was going to 15, you would have written down how happy you were and how excited and how good it made you feel to have your portfolio going up every day. And then in August, most people would have written how miserable they were now that prices had crashed. And the lesson to take from that as you look back on those journal entries is that there's a lot of information in your emotion, but it's backwards. When you feel good, you should actually worry. And when you feel worried, you should recognize an opportunity. And that's hard for most people to do. It's probably impossible if you don't keep records of it. And it's made a lot of money for Warren Buffett.
Thanks, Michael, for the call. We're talking with the author of the book, Your Money and Your Brain, How the New Science of Neuroeconomics Can Help Make You Rich, Jason Zweig. And you can talk with Jason or ask a question about this new research into what happens in the brain during financial decision making and how you can make that work to your financial advantage. 1-800-642-1234 in Madison, 263-1890. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network. This is the Ideas Network. I'm Joy Cardine. Coming up after 9 o'clock, it's open line time for Kathleen Dunn, her September open line, when you can call in with your program ideas and guest suggestions. That's coming up in our next hour. We're talking about our relationship with money and how our brain reacts when it comes to making decisions about money and the whole field of neuroeconomics. 1-800-642-1234 in Madison, 263-1890. It helps explain why smart people sometimes make dumb investing decisions based on emotions, perhaps. Daryl in Bloomington is with us next. Hi, you're on the air.
Hi, Joy.
Mm-hmm. Hi, Daryl.
I'm going to give you a overview of the situation. Way back years ago, when the country was developing, I think you could invest and make a lot of money over a long period of time if you were a young person. In this day and age, if you're middle-aged or past, I would look out, because what you have to look at, in my opinion, this is just my opinion, but I've been watching a lot of factors. And what, think of the things, the events that can happen that can tank the market. And I mean everything. I don't care how safe you think your investment is in any stock, in any market like that. It can tank, and I mean it can tank and stay tanked, because we are totally dependent on a whole lot of factors. Mm-hmm. The stocks are all way overvalued, way overvalued.
Yeah. So, Daryl, I take it you don't invest in the stock market.
Well, there were a number of factors that normally I wouldn't have, and I ended up getting in it just before the 2000, you know, where the initial crash came. And I had money in supposedly safe investments, but they tanked, and the NASDAQ has never came back.
Yeah, right? That's correct.
Mm-hmm. And here's the thing. If you want to play this game, you can torture yourself. I just let it go, you know. But you don't have that money to invest. You can't become an entrepreneur. You can't. There's so many other areas that you can use that investment in. Now, you could, if you were in real estate, you could flip houses when the market was good in the home market. And you could make $100,000, $200,000 on these bigger investment homes just by flipping one. Now you can't, because it's tanked and you can't move them. But I've got a youngster that's in that field, and it was a good field. It's not a good field now. But I'm telling you, I wouldn't. There's a lot of other places where you can put your money where you don't have to worry about it.
Well, let me jump in, Daryl, and give you a couple of thoughts. The first is, I can't say I totally disagree with you. I said earlier on the air that, you know, there really isn't such a thing as a risk-free investment, and I do believe that's true. Just about everything has some kind of risk in it. If it didn't, there wouldn't be much potential for a reward. And I agree with you. There are a lot of things that should worry Americans as they contemplate investing in the stock market. Terrorism, oil prices, interest rates, inflation, and that's just the beginning of the list. But there's a couple things that are also important to realize. The first is, there have always been things to worry about. If we went back 10 or 20 years ago, we would have worried about the Cold War. Mm-hmm. If we went back 30 or 40 years ago, we would have worried about war all over the world of all kinds. Disease was rampant. Poverty was an endemic problem all over the world. The world has never been a perfectly secure, safe place, and there never has been some kind of paradise where investing was risk-free. My dad used to say that the good old days never were. And you think about the times when the stock market has been an especially good investment, it wasn't necessarily when the outlook was all that obviously good. The 1950s, for example, there could have been a nuclear war at any moment and could have been the end of life as we knew it, but the 1950s were one of the best decades in the history of the stock market. The second point I would make is that it's a big world out there. And I agree with you, the U.S. has a lot of problems and faces a lot of risk, like being dominated maybe by China and India down the road. So what you might want to do is invest some of your money outside the U.S. in the hopes that those other economies will do even better. And if they do, as a U.S. investor, you can prosper from that. I think the only sensible thing to do is be diversified and place your bets on just about every financial asset, including some real estate, and be a patient investor and don't overreact to the short-term swings. That's the real risk.
Thank you very much, Daryl, for the call. Jason, another thing my financial advisor was trying to encourage me to change from one mutual fund package that wasn't doing as well as he thought it should be doing into another one. And he showed me this chart that showed that its gains over the past many quarters or years has been going up, up, up. You have a section in the book a little bit on how that might influence me to, yes, make that decision to go into that mutual fund, but I might not be making that the right decision.
Well, yeah, I mean, the problem here, Joy, is that we all want the past to predict the future.
Mm-hmm.
But that's not what the past does. The past just tells us what did happen. It doesn't tell us what will happen. And if I were presented with information showing me that a mutual fund had been doing much better in the past than another one, I would be concerned that in the future it might not do as well because of that law of financial gravity we were talking about earlier. It's very mm-hmm. difficult for one investment or one investment manager to outperform nonstop. Eventually, trends reverse, and a fund that's been hot is more likely to turn cold before long.
Sounds like I should get a new financial advisor.
Oh, I don't want to say that on the air.
Fred in Waters Meet, Michigan. Hi, you're on the air.
Hi, just wanted to make a few comments. For the average investor, what I do is I buy all my financial magazines on eBay, so I'm able to buy Kiplinger and Money and Smart Money and Forbes at discount prices. The other thing that I've always done is on mutual funds, of course, is to buy no loads, but also look to see what the performance has been in down markets or bear markets as well as bull markets. And then the other thing that's made me a multimillionaire is on my 401k plan, we had a lot of different options, mutual funds, as well as the company stock plan. And what I would do is I'd invest in the company stock plan. And when there would be a significant pop, like, say, yesterday with the 300-point up in the Dow, well, if there was a corresponding jump in the company stock, I would trade out of that and just set my money in the money market. So I traded in and out like that. Over a course, I think, about 6 or 7 years, and took a $270,000, I think, was what the value of my 401k plan was in the beginning. And now it's very well over $1 million.
Yeah.
And
Fred, will you be my financial advisor?
This is just my way of doing it. And then what was so neat about it was because it's a 401k plan, there's no stock, there's no commissions.
Yeah.
So every time I made a trade, because it was a 401k, I wasn't hit with any trade fee that way. So I tracked that company stock every day, day in, day out, 52 weeks a year. And not every time I flipped was it positive. But the most of the flips far outweighed
yeah.
the gains. So at the end, with a significant pop, I would be making, you know, maybe $200,000 plus in one day. Just, you know, if the
yeah.
Dow would go up, say, like 3%, 3.5%. So I just wanted to share those comments that I just did that on my own. The part about the no loads and the magazines and all that stuff I read about. But the other part I just did on my own.
Well, Fred, that's you've got a very interesting three-pronged mm-hmm. strategy there. My bosses at Money Magazine will not be pleased about the first part, but I happen to think that's a great idea. You're a man after my own heart who squeezes pennies until they bleed. Your approach to company stock is very interesting. Most people can't let go of it. They feel almost an irrational kind of loyalty to it because it's almost like selling part of them. And being able to detach yourself and to have a sense that the stock may be, getting overvalued is a very, very interesting approach. And your idea to stick to no-load mutual funds is a wonderful way to keep costs low. So I think you've got a lot of interesting ideas there.
Yeah, thank you very much, Fred, for the call. Jason, can you explain why some of us, myself included, may buy a Powerball or a lottery ticket once in a blue moon when it's the jackpot's a gazillion dollars, but the odds are also much more than they would be typically? Why do we do that?
Well, Joy, we do that because the jackpot is what gets us going,
mm-hmm.
and the odds are an abstraction. You know, there's not much difference in the way your brain processes odds of 1 in 10 million from how it processes odds of 1 in 100 million. I mean, they're both ridiculously remote,
mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
and you just shrug and say, well, I don't have any chance of winning either one of those, so who cares? But when the jackpot goes to, say, $300 million, you don't care what the odds are. All you care about is how big the jackpot is, and you know your odds of winning it are ridiculously remote. But you say to yourself, well, usually somebody does win it. Maybe it'll be me.
Yeah, and it's only a buck.
And it's only a buck. And the amazing thing about the lottery, of course, is that even people who win the lottery continue to play it because there's no thrill quite like buying that ticket and thinking that you might get it. And then, of course, winning it is fabulous. The trick is, the amazing thing about jackpots like lotteries, is if you interview people who've actually won the grand prize 3 to 5 years after they won.
Yeah, they're in the poorhouse, aren't they?
They're usually less happy than they were before they won the money.
Yeah.
It's a little scary, actually.
Yeah. And I wish we had more time now. There's so much more to talk about, and the hour is over. So
I guess we hit the jackpot.
Yeah, that's right. We'll have to do it again sometime. Thanks very much for being with us.
My pleasure, Joy. Yeah. Thank you.
Jason Zweig, author of Your Money and Your Brain, How the New Science of Neuroeconomics Can Help Make You Rich. We thank him for being with us, and we thank you for listening along, and we thank Karen Prager and Leo Duran for producing this hour. If you'd like a CD of this or any of our talk shows, call the radio store, 1-800-747-7444. Or you can listen to our talk shows archived on our website, wpr.org. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.